Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
You know, especially as I get older, I've become interested in memory. Like, where's my memory gone? How often have I laid my car keys down? I walk into another room and I'm like, where did I put my keys? Where are my glasses? And go to the grocery store. Oh, I forgot my list. What was on the list? Why can't I remember? You know, I am told sometimes when I will remember an account or remember something that happened, to be like, well, I don't remember it that way. Well, which one of us is correct? Whose memory is more accurate? And what biases feed into the alteration of memory? Can memories be planted? Well, that's what today's broadcast is going to be about. I have the honor of speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Loftus. She got her PhD from Stanford. She is an expert on human memory, and she's been involved in some very high-profile cases over the decades. Some of the stuff that you and I've read about in the headlines, well, she, in many cases, has been right there at ground zero. She's been part of that. She's also been part of some experiments where they attempt to plant false memories in people to convince them that something happened to them that never actually did. And, of course, it sounds very conspiratorial and sinister when you say it. It's like they got scooped up in the middle of the night by the black van and taken off for reprogramming. And it's nothing like that. It's just that they take these people and they surround them with suggestion and they use specific tactics. And before you know it, people start to remember stuff that didn't actually happen to them. Well, that's fascinating. Bias in the brain. How susceptible are we to having our memories altered? How does this relate to religious experiences? How many times have we been speaking to someone desperate to convince us of the supernatural? And their arguments are what? They're about what they remember happening. Well, how accurate is that? The eyewitnesses to specific things, whether physical or supernatural. How reliable is all of this eyewitness testimony? Today is a show about the science of memory. It's going to be a good one, so stick around for that. Next Tuesday's show, I've had on the docket for a few weeks. I can't wait to have this conversation with Ron Miscavige. Now, if the last name Miscavige sounds familiar to you, it's probably because you've been watching some of the documentaries and the exposés about the Church of Scientology. Ron Miscavige is the father of David Miscavige. And of course, David Miscavige is the leader of the Church of Scientology. This is a wild story. Decades ago, Ron gets his son involved. His whole family, essentially, gets him involved in Scientology. Ron's watching his son grow into a position of great power and prominence to lead the church, ultimately. Ron's in his 70s. He all of a sudden looks around and realizes it's a bunch of crap. And the Church of Scientology, the cult of Scientology, is doing some real damage. And he escapes the church and he writes a book about the whole thing. And the book's called Ruthless. Well, Ron Miscavige is going to talk to us next Tuesday about the church, about his son, about the escape, and about the book he has written that exposes some of the insanity behind the scenes at the Church of Scientology. That's coming up next Tuesday, okay? 2 weeks from today is a show I'm calling Jesus on a Fish Stick. And it's going to talk about many of these so-called miracles and manifestations of Jesus, or, you know, pick a god. You know, we're going to talk about several different religions. There'll be a lot of Christianity, though. And some of it's going to be just fun. The stuff that you and I have seen in the headlines over the years, you know, the Virgin Mary toast and the weeping statues and the cloud formations. And we're going to talk about, you know, the plane crash that kills 250 people and one person survives and they're called a miracle, and how insane all of this type of stuff is. So we're going to get into that in 2 weeks. Now, rounding out the month of March, for the last show in the month of March, 3 weeks from today, if you happen to be listening and you're a Christian and you believe in a literal Satan, where you're going to want to dig out the holy water and all your crucifixes, garlic, I mean, whatever you feel like you have to do, okay? Because in 3 weeks, I'm talking to Lucian Greaves on the radio. Now, Lucian Greaves is the co-founder of the Satanic Temple. That's right. Right here on the show, we're going to have verbal communion with the minion of Beelzebub himself. And really, the main reason I wanted to talk to Lucian about the Satanic Temple is because they've so often recently been in the headlines about this blurring of the church state line. This happened to us in Oklahoma, where they've got this big Ten Commandments monument on government property, on taxpayer-funded property. And they're framing it as religious freedom or our Judeo-Christian heritage or whatever it is they're doing over there. But they've got the Ten Commandments, like a religious icon on display on government property. And so the Satanic Temple says, hey, wait a minute. You mean we can put monuments to gods on government property? Awesome. We'll be right over. We'll just put it up right next to your Ten Commandments statue, and we can all live happily ever after. And of course, the Christian politicians and the pastors and all these Sunday Christians around here just flip out. They can't see the hypocrisy of embracing their own religious monument while rejecting somebody else's. And so Lucian and the Satanic Temple have been using these monuments as a way of just demonstrating the insanity of it all. So we're going to talk to Lucian Greaves about some of the stuff they're doing, these monuments. What's the Satanic Temple about? Do they really believe in Satan, like a literal Satan? Or is he just a symbol, as he is with Levian Satanism? It's going to be an interesting show in 3 weeks. We'll get into our conversation tonight, the conversation about memory, with Dr. Elizabeth Loftus here in just a second. But first, I want to thank our show sponsor for making the show possible at Stamps.com. Mailing and shipping, letters, postcards, bill payments, business correspondence, greeting cards, packages, whatever, is now something that you can easily do from your very own desk with Stamps.com. Stamps.com is a huge time and money saver, which makes it a great way to grow your business because Stamps.com eliminates the expensive postage meters, the cumbersome rolls of stamps, the guesswork. You can click, print, and mail from your very own desk and printer 24 hours a day, any letter, any package, any mail class. Stamps.com will even help you determine which class of mail will best meet your needs. And with their digital scale that plugs right into your computer, you know exactly how much postage you require. I use Stamps.com because it saves me time and energy and money. Right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com experience with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Seth Andrews. No space, just Seth Andrews. That's Stamps.com. Enter Seth Andrews. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. My special guest today is an expert in psychology and law, eyewitness testimony, courtroom procedure, and of course, human memory. She is a professor of psychology and social behavior and a professor of law at the University of California, Irvine. She is one of the nation's leading experts on memory. And she joins me for the broadcast today. Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right, so I've already introduced you, but let's go more in depth. Introduce yourself. Give me your background and your area of expertise, okay?
So I am a cognitive psychologist. I am a professor at the University of California, Irvine, and I teach various courses in psychology. And my specialty is human memory. And what I study about memory is how people can believe and remember that they had experiences that they didn't really have. I study false memories.
Can you give me some of the more famous or notorious cases that you've been involved with in your career, cases involving memory and your expertise?
Well, I have been involved as a consultant or an expert witness in a number of cases involving high-profile people like Timothy McVeigh, who was convicted of being the Oklahoma bomber, or Michael Jackson, who was accused of sex abuse, Martha Stewart, who was accused of lying about a stock that she sold, But also, I've been involved in cases of people who you've never heard of, whose lives were completely devastated by the accusations. So in a TED Talk that I gave, I talk about one of the most poignant cases for me, which is a man named Steve Titus, who was falsely identified as being a rapist, but convicted based on the confident, detailed testimony of the rape victim. Ultimately, it was shown that he was innocent. And so he filed a lawsuit, but before he could have his day in court, in civil court, he died of a heart attack at the age of 35, a stress-related heart attack. So, you know, those are the cases that really stick with me.
People think they're doing the right thing. They may think they remember it correctly. They are absolutely convinced. They sound believable. But many times these are misleading accounts.
Exactly. And this even happens when people have the best of intentions. And I mean, who doesn't want to see a crime solved, and who doesn't want to be helpful? And what often happens is as these cases are proceeding to trial, information comes back to the eyewitness that artificially increases their confidence and makes them even more persuasive when they get on the stand and point the finger, and that's the guy, and I'll never forget the face. So you do need to investigate whether there are things that are artificially influencing what an eyewitness says when they get before the jury.
Do you deal at all with repressed memories? People talk about, this happened to you, but you have repressed it. Do you enter that field at all?
I do, yes, because you know, some of the cases, the court cases that I work on, and some of the situations that I've studied are situations where people are claiming that they repressed their memory for, let's say, a decade's worth of horrific brutalization and were completely unaware of it until often they went into some kind of psychotherapy and supposedly recovered these repressed memories. So I do work on those kinds of cases and have seen situations, many situations, where people develop what they think are repressed memories, but they end up being false memories.
So is it real science behind the idea of a repressed memory, or is it all pseudoscience?
Well, in my opinion, there is no credible scientific support for the idea of massive repression. There is certainly support and scientific evidence for the idea that people cannot think about things that were upsetting at the time and be reminded of them and remember things they haven't thought about or remembered in a while. But this idea of massive repression, that these all this brutalization is banished into the unconscious, walled off from the rest of mental life, and that you need to dig it out in order to cure yourself of your problems. It's that concept that a Harvard psychology professor has called folklore, for which there is no credible scientific support.
This sounds like fertile ground for someone to plant suggestion. You get someone who is vulnerable, who is ready to believe that they may have repressed something or forgotten a key experience that's impacted their lives, and some suggestion might take place there. We've seen this often, right? People are saying, this happened to you, you just don't remember it correctly.
Something very, very similar to that was going on in lots and lots of psychotherapy offices, where the patient would come in with one problem, maybe an eating disorder or maybe depression, and the therapist would say something like, you know, everyone in my experience who has those symptoms was sexually abused as a child. Maybe something like that happened to you. And even when the patient denies that childhood experience, the therapist might persist in trying to uncover repressed memories of horrific abuse because the therapist thinks that that is what's needed to cure the patient. And, you know, that belief system was very widespread. Those tactics and practices were widespread, and it led to a lot of devastation of families.
I'm reminded of the Satanic Panic and the famous McMartin trial. Can you sort of flesh out the McMartin trial and how suggestion was used and then how lives were ruined because of the bad science being implemented there?
Well, the McMartin situation is a little bit different. There was a preschool in Manhattan Beach, California, the McMartin preschool. And there was an individual, a kid, and that kid's mother who who knows what went on with the kid and the mother, but the mother decided that the kid was abused at the preschool, and the police started to investigate and see whether there were other kids who were maybe abused, and mental health professionals got involved and started highly suggestive questioning techniques with other kids. And you ended up with lots and lots of these, you know, young children accusing the teachers and owners of this preschool of abuse. And then what happened was a criminal trial. In fact, it was a pair of criminal trials, because after the first trial, the defendants were all acquitted on all charges except for those involving three kids, where there was a hung jury. Then there was a new trial based on the accusations of those three kids, where there was a hung jury, and again, a hung jury. So even though some of these defendants spent years in jail and gobs of money was spent on these criminal cases, there never was a conviction. And it's considered, you know, one of the most egregious cases of suggestive interviewing that led to false memories in young children. So then we started to see different communities having their own little mini McMartin. Again, accusations made by these very young children. But the kinds of situations that I've been involved in later were accusations being brought by grown individuals who were claiming they repressed their memories of childhood trauma. So what these two situations have in common is highly suggestive things were going on, in one case influencing the kids, in the other case influencing the therapy patients.
So if you have young children who are, you know, they have imaginations and they're being encouraged or even coached by the psychologist or whatnot, how reliable could their testimony be? Obviously, we don't want to ignore a child who says that they have been abused, but someone approach that, right?
Yes, obviously. And it, you know, if children are handled and treated carefully, you can obviously get some accurate information from them. But the real problem is when these highly suggestive techniques are being used, things like saying to the kid, other kids have told us, oh, why don't you be smart like them, or offering rewards if they'll just say certain things. And that's when you have to be really suspicious.
Really? You give me the right answer and you'll get a treat or reward?
Yeah, we'll go to McDonald's and you'll get a treat. Yes.
So what are some of the techniques that might be used outside of that? And this could be an adult or a child. How might someone impact how I remember something, or perhaps cause me to remember it incorrectly?
I'll give you an example again of the situation that I mostly see, which is these adult patients. She goes into therapy. She's got maybe an eating disorder, or she's depressed, or, you know, she's got a problem, and so she's seeking some help. And the therapist says something like, you know, many of the patients I've seen with your symptoms were sexually abused as a child. The patient says, no, nothing like that happened to me. Well, in many situations, the therapist says people will repress their memories. And when you start to feel safe, these memories will come back. So why don't we try a little guided imagination to see if we can find these memories? Or maybe the therapist will do some inappropriate dream interpretation. Or maybe the therapist will try hypnosis to dig out these allegedly buried trauma memories. And using these kinds of techniques can lead these patients to start to visualize, to start to imagine, and to start to believe and then remember, or think they remember, that they had these experiences. And in the process, many patients have developed false memories. They've accused their family members or other former neighbors or former dentists or, you know, former anybody of this horrific behavior and caused a lot of tragedy in these extended families.
Talking here with Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, I had the chance to speak with you in person at a conference in California. And I was speaking about a specific episode of a television show called Brain Games, where they had set up, I think, they'd staged a mugging or something, and they had eyewitnesses all around. And you stopped me and you said that you'd actually been involved in the production of that episode in some way. Can you flesh that out for me?
Sure. That was a project of National Geographic. And it was a great program, and they aired about an hour's worth of a program on memory. And as part of that memory program, what they did was they staged an event in a park in New York. They had a bunch of witnesses who they brought in there to watch a card game. And then all of a sudden, in the background, you hear this woman screaming, and then there's this staged mugging. And now you've got all these witnesses to this mugging. Those witnesses were then questioned about their experience. They were brought to a particular room where I came to New York and actually did some questioning of these witnesses. And we tried to deliberately distort their memories for what they had seen so that we could illustrate the process by which memory can be deliberately distorted or out there in the real world, sometimes inadvertently distorted. And that program aired a few years ago. So it was a beautiful production. And
which memory were you trying to alter or change in the minds of the subjects? What specifically were they getting wrong?
Well, the way that we tried to distort the memories of these witnesses was to plant a couple of shills in the group who would utter something wrong deliberately. So one of these shills in the group was supposed to say something like, the woman who was involved in this mugging situation had a red coat, when in fact the coat was like grayish. And so what we had hoped is we would get other witnesses to say they remembered a red coat. The funny thing that happened in this demonstration, and you know, when you're doing a kind of a live demonstration, you can never predict what's going to happen, is another actual witness yelled out, no, it wasn't red, it was white. In other words, rejecting the misinformation. But white was a wrong answer too. And after this one witness said white, another one said, well, me too, I saw white. So what we got to observe is almost like a natural misinformation experiment here, where one witness utters something wrong and another witness picks up on it and says, that's what I saw too.
If I am accused of the mugging, right, and I'm in a court of law and I'm facing eyewitness testimony, I mean, how terrified should I be?
People should be terrified because it just takes one eyewitness, and that witness might be mistaken, to be enough to convince a jury that somebody is guilty. Because what those jurors are responding to is the confidence level of the witness or the detail that the witness expresses, sometimes the emotion that the witness expresses. And if you have a confident and detailed and emotional witness, it's very powerful testimony, even if it's completely wrong.
So you're saying that if they provide a measure of detail, even if it's incorrect information, if they are giving a lot of specifics, they sound more credible to a jury or to passersby, right?
Right. In fact, that's been shown in experiments that providing detail makes a version be more credible, more believable, and it persuades people. Now, if you can actually prove that some of those details are completely wrong, you may be able to get somewhere. But oftentimes, you can't prove the details are wrong. They're just details. You know, if a witness says, well, right before he pulled the gun, he picked up a bar of Snickers, you know, that's pretty detailed, and it may not be possible to prove that it's wrong.
Is eyewitness testimony used often? Is it considered reliable in courts of law?
Eyewitness testimony is used very often. In fact, there is one project in the United States, the Innocence Project, that has gathered information on close to 350 cases of wrongful conviction, people who spent 10, 15, 20 years in prison for crimes that we now know they didn't do because DNA testing has proven that they were actually innocent. And when those cases have been analyzed, it's been shown that, you know, over 70% of them were due to faulty human memory, faulty eyewitness testimony. So we know in that sample, that special sample of cases, that eyewitness testimony was involved and it was a key reason for the wrongful conviction.
Talking here with cognitive psychologist and an expert on memory, Dr. Elizabeth Loftus. I want to get more into belief in the brain, which is really the main reason we're speaking. Can you sort of give me a primer on how memories are formed? how is it that I can remember something in great detail, supposedly that happened 25 years ago, but I can't remember why I walked into the living room? was I looking for my keys or, what was I doing? Can you speak to us a little bit about how memories are formed?
Well, we talk about three stages of the memory process. Something happens and you store bits and pieces of experience at that time. We call that the acquisition phase of the process. Then time passes. We call that the retention phase. And then at some point, you may want to retrieve information about that past event. You may want to answer some questions. You may want to tell somebody a story. You may want to testify in court. Whatever you're doing, you're trying to retrieve information about a past event. We call that the retrieval phase. So our job as researchers in this area is to identify factors that come into play at each of those three stages that affect the accuracy of somebody's memory. And that's what I and other cognitive psychologists do who study this process. So when you try to retrieve information about a past event, actually what you're doing is reconstructing the event. And so you're not playing back a video recording. The memory doesn't work like that. You are, in some sense, constructing what feels like remembering. And it is influenced by other things that have happened after the critical event is over. It's influenced by circumstances that exist at the time you're trying to remember. And those circumstances can affect how and what you remember. And that's why when we construct what we feel like is a past memory, it can contain bits and pieces of error.
We do a lot of speaking to people who have supernatural experience or claim supernatural encounters and talk about detail. I was swept up into heaven, or I saw this miracle or supernatural event take place, and they speak about this stuff with tremendous conviction. How does memory and perception play into much of this? We can't prove it, but we just know for sure that it happened. I remember it like it was 5 minutes ago. Can we speak about perception and memory in regard to supernatural claims?
I haven't read that much about the particular kind of memory you've just alluded to, but one that is kind of similar is the reports of people who've been abducted by aliens and taken up on spaceships and sexually experimented upon and then returned to their beds on Earth. And, many, 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 many people believe that these are false memories. So the question is, if they're false, where do they come from? And how is it that the individuals who possess what they think are memories can feel so committed to them? And in many of these cases, hypnosis was involved, suggestion, interpretation of some difficult to explain symptoms as if they were caused by some kind of alien intervention. And I think that in some of these cases, maybe most of these cases, maybe all of these cases, people are having basically a powerful imagination experience contributed to by all the suggestion, and they come to believe these imagined experiences as if they're real.
How vulnerable are we, though? I mean, if I'm around someone who knows how to manipulate perception, who knows how to implant those little seeds of bias, who knows how to suggest in a specific way, I mean, am I just easy meat for these people?
Well, and
what's the defense?
We have not yet found a group of people who are immune to these kinds of influences. I mean, of course, we don't have a lot of people running around thinking they were abducted by aliens and taken up into spaceships, but we do have lots of people who have other sorts of false beliefs and false memories. In the experimental work, we have tried to find groups of people, if they exist, who might be especially resistant to these, but even a group of people with super memories, super personal memories, people who remember just about everything they did every day of their adult life. They're a rare group of people, but they do exist, and they've been studied by my colleagues at the University of California, Irvine. They've been featured on 60 Minutes several times. Even they are susceptible to having their memories distorted, contaminated, transformed by the power of suggestion.
Can you give me some examples, a few examples of experiments you've been involved in where you successfully implanted a false memory?
Well, sure. One of the first studies that we published on what we now call rich false memories, where we're going to plant an entire memory in your mind, was a study where we planted a childhood memory that when you were 5 or 6 years old, you were lost in a shopping mall, you were frightened, you were crying, you were ultimately rescued by an elderly person and reunited with the family. We were able to plant a partial or complete false memory in about a quarter of our sample of adults after 3 suggestive interviews. And the way we did it, if I were doing that with you, I'd say, well, Seth, we've talked to your mother, and we found out some things that happened to you when you were 5 or 6 years old. And we'd just like to see, you know, what you can remember about the things your mother told us about. And then we'll ask you about some true experiences, things your mother told us really did happen to you when you were 5 or 6 years old, just to give it a little credibility. And then we'll ask you about an experience that is completely made up, that we've made up with the help of your mother, about being lost in the mall and rescued and reunited with the family. And with this fairly strong form of suggestion, as I said, we were able to get about a quarter of our otherwise ordinary, healthy human beings to remember all or part of this experience. And then other investigators from different laboratories around the world came along and planted false memories using a similar technique that were even more unusual or more bizarre. That you nearly drowned as a child and had to be rescued by a lifeguard, that you were attacked by a vicious animal, that you committed a crime as a teenager that was serious enough that the police came, that you cheated in a game that you were playing and took money from the game bank when you weren't supposed to take the money. These are very rich false memories that scientists have planted in the minds of ordinary people in order to study the process by which this happens out there in the real world.
So if I was some sort of a spiritual leader, a guru, some mentor, someone that you gave a measure of trust to, if I knew the right tactics and tricks, could do this to individuals, to an entire congregation?
Sure you could. We can take a whole group of people and make them believe that they, you know, not all of them, but a significant number of them, that they got sick on a particular food as a child, or they got sick on some other substance as a teenager, by the power of suggestion.
Let me ask a more philosophical question. I guess it's philosophical. If you could have a photographic memory, you're an expert on memory. If you could remember everything that happened in your life in perfect detail, and I've wanted this for myself from time to time, right? Would you want that ability? Would you want a photographic memory?
Well, I'd like it to work in some situations. I'd love it to work when I wanted to remember somebody's name or the spouse or partner of somebody or the name of their kids or, you know, something that would be useful for social interaction. But I wouldn't want it for everything. And I'll tell you why I say that. I've talked with you a lot about how suggestion can alter people's memories, but we don't need external suggestion. We can do it to ourselves. And so there are studies in my field that show, for example, that people remember that their grades were better than they really were. They remember they gave more to charity than they really did. They remember they voted in elections they didn't vote in. They remember that their kids walked and talked at an earlier age than they really did. These prestige-enhancing memories maybe allow us to feel a little better about ourselves and maybe live a little bit happier a life. And depressed people don't have this kind of memory distortion, that prestige-enhancing memory distortion. So I'm not sure I would want to remember, you know, all the sadnesses, all the failures, all the things that might drag me down if I had that perfect memory.
If you had experienced some kind of trauma or witnessed a horrific event, you might want to mute those memories in your own mind just for sanity's sake, I guess.
Well, I personally would, yes.
Yeah. Is there something I can do to increase my memory? I'm pushing 50. I'm pushing it kind of hard, right? And I'm starting to get to that point where I'm at a party and someone introduces themselves. And 30 seconds later, I'm like, shit, I just caught their name and it's gone, you know? And I see these sort of exercises, these things they say you can do. Learn a second language at midlife, all these times. Are there ways, Dr. Loftus, that I could have a better memory?
Well, there are certainly some strategies you can develop. There are obviously tricks you can use to remember particular kinds of things. But those tricks sometimes take a lot of effort and work. And many people are not going to want to take the time of effort and work to do that on a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour, daily basis. But just as general strategy, you need to figure out how to pay better attention in the first place. A lot of times we don't remember a name that is said to us because we're not really paying attention. So pay better attention in the first place and then rehearse. And by rehearse, I mean you meet somebody, they tell you their name is Melissa, you want to remember that name. How do you rehearse it? You might think to yourself, well, should I just say Melissa, Melissa, Melissa 10 times in a row? Will that do it? That kind of massed rehearsal is not as good as spaced rehearsal, saying Melissa, waiting a while, saying Melissa. But what should the pattern of spacing be? And we know a lot about the optimal patterns of spacing. So it's not even spacing. You don't every 5 minutes say Melissa, but you wait a minute, you say to yourself, Melissa. Now you wait 5 more minutes, say Melissa. Now you wait 15 more minutes. You see that expanding pattern. That's the pattern that leads to the maximum ability to get the information into your long-term memory so that you'll have it available when you want to use it.
How about abstract memory exercises? I've heard that if you take a word or memory and then you create some sort of bizarre scenario around it, it becomes so bizarre that you can't help but remember it. Have you explored that at all?
Well, there are people who have used, you know, imagery to link, let's say, two ideas together so that when you come upon one, the image emerges and then you can remember the other. That certainly sometimes works. That's one of those techniques that it takes some time, a little time and effort. And are you going to walk through your daily life, you know, conjuring up these bizarre images to link things together? Maybe not.
Loch Ness monster in tennis shoes riding a Harley Davidson. I mean, all these bizarre sort of things you link together. And then they say that if they're bizarre enough, then you will remember. But I didn't know if that had any merit or not.
It can help.
Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, if there was a book, a resource, a website, some place where my listeners could perhaps go deeper to learn more about memory and the brain, perception, all the things that we've been speaking about and more, I'd like to leave them with resources. Anything you would recommend, a place you would, a destination you would send them?
Well, first of all, if you want to like a pretty easy to digest 15-minute TED Talk, you can go to the TED website and just watch the TED Talk that I gave on memory. And then if you want more, I have a website at the University of California, Irvine, where I have something like 50 articles and extensive journalistic discussions of this work, links to it that you can just help yourself for free.
I will include links to both the TED Talk and that webpage in the description box of this broadcast for easy access. Dr. Loftus, you've been an amazing guest, and it's been a compelling conversation. So thank you for joining us on the radio, and we'll look forward to seeing you out there on the road, okay?
Okay, great. Thanks.
That's the show today. Don't forget, I'm back next week with a conversation with Ron Miscavige to talk about the Church of Scientology. Don't forget, my patrons on Patreon get a completely commercial-free broadcast and an extra show every single month. So if you'd like to support me on Patreon, the website is patreon.com/SethAndrews. Have a wonderful week. I'll see you back here next Tuesday on the Thinking Atheist Radio Podcast.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.